How we doing tonight? How's everybody doing? Welcome to another episode of The Bog. I'd like everybody to forgive the sound of my voice. I am still struggling with this week-long cold, so if I'm coughing and hacking and everything, my apologies. I still wanted to come on tonight because tonight is such a wonderful, very important, foundational topic that we all need to start, you know, really, really getting into and stuff like that. And I really appreciate everybody coming in tonight, but I want you guys to make sure you like, subscribe, share, and click the little alert button so you get alert every time we go live here on Dave Martell channel here on The Bog, which is every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern with me and Tristan and all the other stuff that I do. I do streams in my car. I upload videos. Whatever comes out of my mind comes out of here. So I want to make sure you guys click the little alert bell because we all know that YouTube is messing with us and stuff like that. Click the bell so you can get alert every time I get some complaints that we don't get any alerts. So I want to make sure that you guys get the alert so you can come join us on The Bog here as we dig into all the topics that we do all the time. Talk about spirituality, science, you know, all kinds of stuff that's within the Germanic tradition. But before we get started, I want to make sure I give a shout out, like always, to my homegirl, Miss Hannah, at Traditional Apothecary. Traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Stop giving your money to the multinational globalist vampires that hate your guts. Stop giving them your money. Give your money to somebody that loves you, opt out of the system that destroys you, and get something that's grown from the earth that's completely organic and good for you. Instead of that stuff that's full of plastics, synthetics, all kinds of weird chemicals, trashes your hair, trashes your body, trashes your skin, get some of this. She's got so much good stuff. Hair conditioner, shampoo, beard oil, you know, lotion. I use it. My wife uses it. Dr. G uses it. So keep your white bright. Keep your beard robust. Keep your mane flowing, just like Big Dave. Go to traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Promo code Dave to get 10% off. Tonight, we are talking about morality and ethics. This is a really important, really, really important topic because this is really the foundational philosophy of understanding and discerning what is right and what is wrong according to how our ancestors viewed it and how we can still view it to this day. And, you know, Mr. Tristan, a couple weeks ago, or maybe it was last week, he mentioned something about, he said, everybody talks about the meat of fury. He always talks about the fury and the berserker rage and all that stuff. Nobody ever mentions about inspiration, the mead of inspiration, which Odin drinks, and it's one of the most powerful spiritual things in our lore and in our history and among our folk and in our theology all over the place. It's the mead of inspiration, the inspiration that comes from the divine that helps us create because our gods are creators. So, you know, I want that to, you know, because of that, you know, that just proves that what comes from the mind is mightier than what comes from the hand. I know it's cliche, but it's so true that the pen is mightier than the sword. And since I'm a little bit under the weather, I'm going to take a sip of this stuff. I want to show you guys something. Brother Brandon, one of my kinsmen who's in my kindred, he makes some of the best darn mead on the planet. Every kindred, if you get out into the real community, every kindred has one mead maker. My mead maker is absolutely excellent, and I want to give him a shout-out. This isn't for sale or anything. It's just for me. This is going to help me with my sickness. I don't know if that's like a doctor thing, if doctors say that, but this is going to be for me. He made this. This is a sizer. This is made with apples. It's a mead made with apples, and it's with raw hibiscus and orange peel, I believe. Absolutely delicious. So I'm going to take a sip of this, but I'm going to quit running my mouth and introduce our co-host, Mr. Tristan. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing just fine, Dave. Happy to be on The Bog once again.
Absolutely.
So, and tonight we do, as you said, have a great, great topic here, the morality and ethics.
So give us a quick rundown. Before we get started here, we last week, in a couple weeks before I always like to try to include my audience in the conversation and read from the chat and stuff like that. But it's, I know everybody has such wonderful, great questions. I don't hit every single question because that's just how I am. Unfortunately, kind of takes away from like the flow of the show and stuff. So we're going to reserve a portion at the end of the show for your questions and stuff. So if you shoot us a super chat, we will absolutely read any sort of question, any sort of thing you wanted to comment about, anything you guys want to add to the show, shoot us a super chat, and we're putting aside a little bit of time at the end to read all the stuff from you guys, which many thanks and many blessings to everybody that's had so many generous donations so far. But Mr. Tristan, tell us about morality and ethics.
Right. So to understand the ethical systems of the Germanic people, we have to realize that in some ways they had a different perspective of the world than we do today. And to explain how we're going to learn this, I'm going to give everyone a walk through some of the basic fundamentals of ethical philosophy here.
Yeah.
We're going to start with the ideas of objectivity and subjectivity, which is critical to the notion of the ancient world and the modern world. The modern world is a very subjective place, as we know. We have the influence of postmodernism and to some extent modernism as well. We're going to define these here. See, objectivity refers to when your moral source is unchanging and it can be ascertained and measured against. Yeah. And there are only really two possible objective sources of morality, and that's either the divine command or natural law.
Mm-hmm.
Now, subjectivity is when your moral source is changeable, it's mutable, and you cannot measure against it, or it varies depending on the person looking at it or on the situation. And that we call that subjective because, as people would figure out, that it changes from person to person. You don't always have the same answer. It would be like looking at the sky. We could all agree that the sky is blue. This is an objective fact. Whereas if the sky is pretty, well, that's rather subjective, even though it is.
Sure. Also, a lot of people would say, you mentioned pretty. There's a lot of arguments that say that attractiveness is objective because it's based on symmetry and based on things like this that are objective.
Right. You can definitely base attractiveness on objective categories, like biologically, what are humans hardwired to find attractive? There's also some arguments about how you could find something attractive based on non-sexual criteria. Like, for instance, we know that a mountain is grand. It's beautiful, right? Well,
yeah.
Just because a mountain is beautiful doesn't mean you want to have sex with a mountain. Because we can determine there that beauty is something that is inherently non-sexual. It's a platonic ideal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there might be some people in 2019 that want to try to, make love to a mountain. I know there's people that are like making love to. We're not gonna get. We're not gonna get all that stuff. You guys,
well,
know
this is
about.
The bog for a reason.
Yeah, those kind of people go into the bog. Those people get bogged. But so what Tristan's talking about is objectivity versus subjectivity, and unfortunately, there is a lot of kind of like this subjectivity, moral relativism, and like all this kind of goofy stuff that goes around in what we would call heathen circles for a long, long time now. And we're here to dispel it and give you authentic information, authentic philosophy that disproves that, so you can lay your foundation when somebody asks you. There's you could build your epistemology and what you would call your apologetics. I know people, you a Christian, man. Your apologetics is a Greek word. It's a word that means having an answer for everything. The Greeks had it. The ancient Greeks had this, where they would have an answer for any question. And in fact, there were Greek rulers that were in the East after the fall of and the death of Alexander the Great that later converted to Buddhism because the apologetics of the Buddhist priests that came around were so good they couldn't go back to their own religion because they got their own religion disproved by these people. So they converted to Buddhism. They became Buddhist rulers, Greek, ethnically Greek Buddhist rulers. So it's,
especially in Afghanistan, it's hard to imagine today, but a long time ago in the classical world, Afghanistan was the domain of Indo-Europeans. It was actually people who worshipped at, if you go far back enough, an almost Hindu religion, and then later Buddhism.
Yeah, absolutely. But so apologetics isn't like a you're just trying to be a Christian kind of thing. Apologetics is just you being able to answer questions, which every single person should do, and that's what we really push with Setianism, is that every Setian. And I did a video about this. Every Setian should be physically dangerous. I know that's already popular among heathen circles, is being good at fighting, shooting, being able to wield violence if need be, being able to be spiritually dangerous, or formidable, being able to like spiritually contain yourself and heal others. But there's one part that really gets overlooked, and that's being intellectually dangerous, being using your mind as a weapon, or being formidable with any foe that comes at you. And you know, this isn't just throwing fists and having fisticuffs. This is anybody that comes at you with any. Well, can you explain this? Why? What is good? Where does good come from? Where does your morality come from? What is the nature of your gods? Where do I go when I die? How do you prove that? Prove that your gods are real. Prove that these places are real. Prove that this. And you should be able, every single Setian should be able to say, oh, okay, yeah, I got that. That is apologetics. And this is the foundation to build your apologetics and also your epistemology.
Right, going back to objectivity and subjectivity here, I do have to state that it's very important for people to understand which kind of morality is which, and also to understand what that means for their own moral ideas. You see, an objective morality, because it's unchanging, it can be used to judge others. If another person doesn't live up to an objective morality, we can measure it against them and say, you have been found wanting. Whereas with a subjective morality, it's so fluid and changing that you can't really apply it to other people. And because you can't apply it to other people, you can't demand moral choices from other people. If you have a subjective morality, you can't look at another person and say, what you're doing is wrong. And it could be something horrible, like, you know, pedophiles, right?
Yeah.
Well, if you have subjective morality, you can't say raping children is wrong, even though you might think it is. It doesn't hold any sort of philosophical weight.
Yeah.
And that's why objective morality is very important.
Absolutely. And so let's get, and you know, we all have objective morality. We just don't know how to explain it. You know, if you go to an average person, like anybody in the chat here, say, pedophilia, right or wrong? Obviously wrong, right? If I say rape, right or wrong, obviously wrong. You know, hurting kids, obviously wrong. You know, victimizing, you know, elderly people, obviously wrong. Why? You know, this is what we're going to get into right now is objectivity. And as Mr. Tristan mentioned, was two parts, natural law and divine command. And Mr. Tristan, tell us about those two things. Start with natural law.
Right. We'll start with divine command
okay,
here.
Sure.
Divine command is... the idea that what is right or wrong is determined by the expressed will of a god or a set of deities. For instance, if Zeus comes down and says, you should be kind to guests when they come to your home, do not turn them away, then it becomes morally incorrect to do so because you can't disobey the god. It should be noted that divine command is sometimes called a subjective source of morality because the whims of the deity can change. But I actually think it's more properly classified as an objective source of morality because the actual source, you know, the morality from the deity is never changing. It always stems from the god.
Now we're kind of getting into, this is something that I wanted to throw in, which was the dilemma of Euthyphro. And Euthyphro. Sorry, it's been a long time since I read that stuff. Euthyphro is a book or a writing by Plato where he talks about Socrates, and this transcends just the Greek tradition. This is just universal logic and universal philosophy that you can apply to just about anything. And okay, so long story short, without getting into all of it, is within the story, there's what is called the dilemma, where Socrates goes to this town, and he comes into contact with this guy named Euthyphro. I can't even say his freaking name right now. So we'll call him this guy, because I'm too sick to say his name. He comes in contact with this guy, and he says, the guy is trying to have his own father executed. And he says, why do you want to have your own father executed? Well, the guy says, well... You know, it's you know, the will of the gods, or it's the will of God, or the will of the divine. And they kind of have like a back and forth, and he starts asking these questions. And it comes to what is called the two horns. And the two horns are, is it good because God commands it, or does God command it because it's good? And in this context, when I say God, I just mean the divine. Could be the gods, could be any sort of the divine command, any sort of divine source that is commanding it. Is it good because they command it, or do they command it because it's good? And my opinion, this is a big problem in this. The two horns here are a big problem in monotheist religion, because they believe that their God is omnipotent. You know what I mean?
Well, specifically any sort of monist religion in which God encompasses all of the universe.
Exactly. And this is not an issue that we have, because we know that the gods are immanent, which means they exist within nature. And Mr. Tristan might disagree with me, but I believe in the polytheist traditions that the gods command them because it is good. It is comes from a source that already exists. And the gods also they adhere to this, this thing as well. You know, I mean, this is something that transcends even the gods that just exists, and they're here to teach us about it. What do you think about that?
No, actually, I don't disagree with that at all, Dave. Oh, okay. I think that's spot on, actually. And I would even specify that we know the source of the gods' morality, and it is Orlog, the Overlaw. In this case, the Overlaw is actually identical to natural law.
Yeah.
So even the gods take their morality from natural law. And as we know, natural law is an objective source. It can be measured against.
Exactly. So there is like a greater font that which this truth or this law and this goodness or whatever you want to call it comes from, that the gods also come from. And they are also, you know, as the Gnostics say, as above, so below. What that means is that what we adhere to here, the laws of nature, they do as well. The gods have to as well, because we all exist within the realms of nature. When I say nature, I don't mean dirt and trees and dogs and like dog turds and all that stuff. I mean all of existence, all of nature, all of the multiverse that is nature, whatever dimension or plane that we're talking about.
Right, we're talking about the metaphysics of reality.
Metaphysics of reality. So everything that we have to adhere to, they do as well. So what our relationship with the gods is that they communicate these laws to us so that we may understand them. And this is a problem that, as Tristan said, all monist and monotheist religions have, is because we know that our gods are not omnipotent. No, nothing is omnipotent. That's ridiculous, in my opinion.
Right, that goes into an entirely different philosophical dilemma there. But it's less of an issue in a polytheistic religion in which gods do not have, they don't have an all-loving nature. They don't have an all-knowing power or all-powerful. And that really changes the matter. But that's also why it's important to realize that the gods determine their morality from Orlog, and as should we. It's from natural law. That's often something I see bandied about, that because our gods do not have this all-encompassing nature, that they're somehow lesser, or they can't, you know, they can't derive anything else from them. When in actuality, we can learn to respond to them and say, no, we can base all of our reasoning upon natural law, just as the gods themselves do.
Absolutely, and with this argument, a lot of times, you know, monists or monotheists will say, especially the Abrahamic variety, they will say, well, God is omnipotent, so therefore all goodness comes from God. That is their divine command. Well, then what I usually bring up is I say, what about when God told Abraham to kill his son? You know, if this is your version of divine command, does that mean that killing your own son then becomes good? How is it that when God tells you to kill your own son, it goes from being good or going being the worst thing ever to being good then? Would then all of society...
And we can see it implicitly arrive at the conclusion that yes, that would be the case, because the God of Abraham, Yahweh, rewards him for trying to kill his son because he commanded it. It seems to be the impression that yes, God can in fact change what is good or what is bad.
Yeah,
which is crazy to think about. It makes the entire notion of morality almost completely redundant. It's just at the whims of this deity.
And it's also really dangerous, because then men that get into institutions that say that they are the ones that discern the word of God, the word of the divine command, can this change and tell you what to do at their whim? And they say, oh, this is divine command. Well, now it's cool to be pedophiles. And that's what God wills, so that's what it is now.
Exactly. Then you don't have any sort of outside reasoning to look at this and say, no, that's wrong.
Exactly. So this is, you mean, what we're talking about, natural law, Erlog, is something that transcends all things. And no matter, like somebody say, well, I'm here to speak, I speak for the gods, and you have to do this. And you say, well, no, that is not in line with Erlog. And the gods only teach Erlog. So, you know, they only teach natural law, and they only teach things that are good. So I'm not going to believe you, goofball.
Right. Actually, to springboard off that, I'll go on to the next topic is deontological ethics. Deontological ethics is the idea that man should perform his duty, whatever it happens to be, and it doesn't matter what result it would be. That's what's the example in the Euthyphro dilemma, where the man is sacrificing his own father because the gods demand it, would be an example of a strict application of deontological ethics along with divine command. But deontological ethics differs from divine command because it could be your duty from anything, from your state, because your father commanded you to do it. Anything that you believe gives you a social or metaphysical duty. And deontological ethics it could also be objective or subjective, depending on the source of what exactly you're basing your duty on.
Sure.
But I would have to note here that deontological ethics often gets a bad rap because it's not real philosophically coherent, but it is a good stopgap measure. For instance, if you're not a scholar, right? You don't really know ethical philosophy. You can't reason what is good or wrong about natural law. You can rely upon, well, the gods told me to do this, or this is my duty because our entire culture demands this of us. And it's a good stopgap measure because most of the time that's probably going to be accurate, even if you don't understand why.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, you have in the notes here about utilitarianism, and that's another one I want to touch on as well.
Right. Utilitarianism is the idea that what produces the best outcome from the largest number of people is right. It's the old trolley problem of, you know, would you kill one person if you could save 17?
Exactly. So it goes back to what is the natural law? What is the rule that transcends above all of human discernment? And that's, you know, a big deal when it comes to establishing and looking to your higher ology. And this is why divine command and natural law are so important, because it's essentially having like a metaphysical rule book. You could say, oh, well, what are the tools that I use to discern this situation? What virtues should I, oh, I could go look at this, the rule book. You know what I'm saying? Not necessarily like there is a specific book that has all the rules laid out or anything like that, but we have texts and teachings and various things that we could go look at and help us build our lens, you could say, that we can view things and discern things properly.
Right, right. I would totally agree with that, Dave. And to continue on here with our list of ethics, we're going to talk about moral subjectivism.
Yeah, we touched on this moral a little bit earlier.
Right, we did. Moral subjectivism is the idea that what is right is what any person individually feels is right at any given time. It's like your feelings, your feels, bro. And of course, that is entirely subjective. That's the height of subjectivism right there. In fact, that's what I believe you would term anal worship.
Yeah. Yeah, that's big time anus worship, and that is the core of all rot within postmodernism. Is, you know, oh well, that's what makes him happy, or that's what's right for him, that's what's true. There's a thing, well, that's what's true for him is not what's true for me, and blah, blah, blah. There's no such thing as what is true for him, what is true. There is only truth. There's only truth. And you don't and change that.
Yeah, and people, you know, they have the idea that if something is right for them, you know, it goes to how they feel about it. Well, maybe you should just leave it alone. And I really want to drill in that moral subjectivism is dangerous for a society. Any society, anywhere, based upon moral subjectivist ideas, will fail and falter and slide into moral decay because you cannot make a strong moral stance and judgment. Judgment is necessary for the upholdance of order.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's... And that goes right into the next one, which is cultural relativism. Cultural relativism is what any given culture accepts as right is right, and that you cannot judge all cultures under the same standard of conduct. This is also very common in modern society, especially amongst the left, in which they refuse to judge other cultures, you know, be whatever ones they have, for doing their own cultural practices. And that shows starts to show the decline of subjective morality right there. If another culture, you know, rapes women all the time habitually, you can't tell them, oh, that's wrong. All they can say is, well, that's just what they do.
Yeah. And in the view of objective morality, which is, you know, absolutely our position, that's just not cool. There's things that are right across the board and things that are wrong across the board. And a lot of times these people, they run it, they're very, very easily to beat in an argument, because all you have to say is, you know, well, they'll be like, oh, well, you know, in Islamic countries, they do this and this and this, and that's just their culture. Well, what about what happened in Germany in World War II? Was that just their culture? And that's that, you know, that sits, they short circuit and start freaking out because they can't continue that logic. It's incoherent because they're just peppering it and applying it whenever they want. They're cherry picking.
You know, you bring up a real good point I didn't even think to discuss in the topic, but it's critical here, that part of the reason why you have to know your ethical philosophies is because most people don't understand it, and they start applying it from lots of different ones, you know, seven different contradictory types of ethics, because that's just, you know, what they've intuited with. They've come up with, well, this must be right because of that. And the way this does, it makes your own ideas philosophically incoherent. You can't defend them. And if you can't defend your ideas to other people, they have no weight.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just cultural relativism. And here's another thing about the cultural relativism and subjectivism. This is stuff that comes out of a lot of these ideologies that are floating around also true, which is, you know, we have like a left-hand path is very, very subjective in a lot of ways. We have perennialism. That's going to trigger people. Perennialism has a lot of moral relativism. You know, it has a lot of subjectivity to it. Would you agree with that, Mr. Tristan?
I would agree with that to an extent. It mostly determines based on exactly what kind of perennial syncretism they've actually come up with, which is another issue with perennialism. It's very wishy-washy, kind of like Wiccanism, where any one of the people could come up with any other thing because, you know, they don't have an actual dogma or something they can be measured against. Yeah. A lot of perennialists are actually Platonists or Neoplatonists in a sense. So in that way, they can definitely determine that something is objective, but it's possible philosophically, but it's not often the case practically.
Yeah, it's a lot of these things. Once you start like really researching and looking into these ideas, it's like, oh wow, that makes perfect sense. I already believed that. Yeah, I mean that's what happened with me. Yeah, when it comes to like Plato and Aristotle and stuff like that, I read that like years ago, and I was like, I was familiar with it. And for our one show like a few weeks ago, Tristan's like, here, go read about virtue ethics and stuff. And it's been like it was like forever since I touched up on it, and I was like, oh man, it says that in the Eddas. I know exactly what this all makes perfect sense again, and it all brought it back to light. And as we said before, when you really get down and you start looking at these definitions of things and how these things make sense, and you really start to reason and self-reflect and be able to discern the world and discern choices and human behavior and what is objective and subjective, and these foundational philosophies are absolutely necessary, and every single Setian and Ossetur should be able to pull these out of their wheelhouse, out of their quiver, to explain their position at any given point. You should be formidable and dangerous intellectually, you know, coming into any sort of contact. What does it say in the Havamal? You know, always keep a spear with you because you don't know what kind of enemy lies beyond the threshold. You know, that's the same thing with epistemology and having the ability to conjure arguments. As you don't know what somebody's going to throw at you, you don't know. The last thing you want is for somebody to say something that you don't have an answer in front of, like, your kin. Because it's like they really lean on you to have the answers, and having answers and arguments in human society, in a noble society specifically, is absolutely important, man. It's absolutely important.
Well, anyone who, you know, cares at all about what is true or what is not or what is right should be able to understand for themselves, well, what is right? I mean, if you don't understand why something is right or wrong, then you're just kind of doing whatever. And that opens the idea that you could be doing wrong things and not even know it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's been this kind of meme that this religion is, there's no such thing as good and evil. There's no such thing as order and chaos. There's no such thing as light and dark. They're all the same. And we, you know, we balance them. And, you know, we don't believe in wrong. Like, you know, all this stuff, which is literally postmodernism. It has nothing to do with the ancient world. Our ancestors would have laughed at it and bogged people that said that kind of stuff. You know, it's not true and it's not real and it it's not part of an authentic tradition. It's injections from postmodernists, and it just needs to go. You know, because what we want to do here is get back in touch with our primordial form, our authentic tradition, as best we can. And if that's not what we're doing, why are we even talking about ancestry and ancestral stuff if you're not trying to do it to the best of your ability like our ancestors did and have an actual authentic tradition? You know what I mean?
And, you know, Dave, I'm glad you mentioned that, because too many people in the pagan community have this reactionary mindset to Christianity where they hate the aspects of Christianity and want to be anything except what they're doing, just the opposite of a Christian. When we have to understand that a lot of the Christian moral concepts and their base framework comes from pagan philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, all the classical Greek models and Roman models here, and it doesn't belong to them. That's not Christian. Aristotle didn't worship Jesus. Aristotle worshipped Zeus. He was a pagan. That belongs to us. This is the morality of our ancestors. Even if you're not Greek, the Greek philosophers here were coming at it from a common Indo-European root. They were themselves trying to figure out, why do we believe this?
Exactly. It's just it was the Greeks, their thing was writing things down, and they were really articulate and meticulous, and they were really brilliant. And I see zero issue with using the work from wonderful minds like Plato and Aristotle.
Well, they saw zero issue with including us under that umbrella as well. If you read the ancient sources, it says they use the phrase the ancient primordial means there, and they will often name Germanic tribes by tradition just to reinforce the idea that, no, everyone does this. The Goths do it, the Vandals do it, you know, all the people of Germania, the Greeks, the Romans, all of these people all have the same tradition. And that was very important to them because they were looking at a common Indo-European tradition without actually realizing it.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. So let's move on here to virtue ethics.
Right. Virtue ethics, which goes handily into what I was just talking about, is the Aristotelian notion. Aristotle first came up with the theory of virtue ethics. And it's that a man should live in balance according to the ancient virtues. And we know that the ancient virtues were derived from natural law. And ancient virtues are things people would be very familiar with, like courage, bravery, honor, honesty. All of the things that everyone knows, this is what makes a noble man, a hero. Mm-hmm. These are the ancient virtues, patience, wisdom.
Absolutely, 100%. And very much we like to meme the heroism and the bravery and the courage and all these stuff, because that's sexy and that's, you know, I don't want to say that's Hollywood, because obviously we do have, you know, great reverence for our heroes and stuff like that. But a lot of people don't take a step back and look at what is the foundation of these heroes, and that is wisdom and knowledge. And, you know, speaking of Aristotle said the key to everything was knowledge. Man, the more knowledge that you gain and you amass, the more that you see truth in the world and the more that you know truth and understand truth. And it's a big deal, and that's something that gets over. People just want to skip the step of knowledge and wisdom and go right to being a badass. That's not how things work, man.
Oh no, we have to understand that ignorance itself is a moral wrong. It leads to bad actions. So to not understand these things, to be ignorant of them, is to have a vice. It is a moral vice. There's something wrong with this person.
Absolutely.
And that's also how we know that virtue ethics are objective. They come from natural law, because when people are courageous and brave and honest and wise and patient, this produces good results. Any person would objectively determine this as being good, desirable. Whereas the opposite is bad. People who are cowards, who are rash, who lie all the time, they have bad results. And that's how we know that that's a moral standard derived from natural law. It's good and bad.
Absolutely. We keep mentioning natural law, and it's tied to Erlog. And I don't think we really dove into that. Could you give us a definition of what natural law is and how it ties to Erlog?
Right. Natural law here is the notion that the universe and the metaphysics of the universe operates in a specific set of ways that we can measure and look against. For instance, all fast people are going to run a race faster than slow people. There is no time, no place in which slow people actually win the race, right? Strong people are always stronger than weak people. And, you know, it's the way the universe works, that this thing is just how the reality functions here. And that we call this the laws of nature, natural law. And from this, we can determine things even more, you know, less observable things. For instance, like honesty is better than deceitfulness, because honesty yields positive outcomes in nature. If you put a bunch of people together and all of them are honest, they will build a much better workable society than a nation of lying backstabbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, we're really tearing through time here. So I want to make sure we cover absolutely everything. The next on the list is consequentialism.
Right. Consequentialism is the idea that man should act based on the foreseen outcome of any given action. So, for instance, actually this is a very important one for Germanic people, because Odin often relies upon a consequentialist morality, and that's why he gets in trouble with all the actual laws of the deities. For instance, in the Rape of Rinder, he thinks that, well, rape is obviously bad. It's not that Odin disagrees, but he believes if I rape this person, it will yield a positive outcome. And so he does so. And that's a great observation of consequentialism, that you should do everything based on whether it would yield to a positive outcome or a negative outcome based on what you did.
Yeah, absolutely. That was, and this was something I was discussing with our boy, Mr. Mark Pereer, was that there wasn't really like an established kind of what was like Christians a lot of times will describe, Abrahamic religions will often describe that goodness, you know, comes from God and like holiness comes from God, and then that's the kind of rule of what goodness is, whereas our ancestors kind of viewed it as there were good and bad action and that people should be punished or rewarded because of action.
Right, that's entirely the case.
So, with consequentialism,
I would have to note here that even though consequentialism is often tied to Odin, that he performs this, it should not be viewed as theologically acceptable for other people to be consequentialist ethics themselves. To put it plainly, you're not Odin. The gods are much wiser than any person, and that's why it goes into using the deontological method as a gap or a stopgap measure. That because the gods are so wise, they can determine what the consequences of any given action must be far better than any given person. You have bias, you have error that may creep in. And because of this, it's often better just to rely upon what you know to be your dutiful rights, what you know, divine command in this sense, or even just to reason out what is natural law. Do not go against it, even if you think it might yield a positive outcome. We have to remember to be more humble, to have the idea that we are better than or more knowledgeable than the gods or strictures or 1,000 years of our ancestors is hubris, and that is a classical sin.
Yeah, big time, big time. You just mentioning hubris. in Hellenismos, the Greek tradition, the Greek people that are polytheists that are practicing now, they view hubris as one of the highest of all crimes, because that's what their gods describe over and over and over again in their stories, is about how hubris was so bad. Now, and this is something that happens in the Germanic, I don't even call this the Germanic tradition, in kind of like left-hand path viewed heathenism or whatever, where they say that, well, we're supposed to emulate the gods. This isn't true. This is actually a very Abrahamic take, because when you say that you're going to emulate the gods, you're literally just, you're becoming a literalist, and you're taking the scripture, so to say, or the text, the sacred text, literally, when in actuality there is much more nuance and many different tools to kind of discern the lore. Like, there's symbolism, and there's like ritual symbols and like all this stuff. There's moral teachings, and it's not just, well, this happened here and this happened here. So when you say, well, I'm going to emulate the gods, how? Why? Because you're taking the text as completely, absolutely literal, which some of it is literal, but there's more nuance to understanding our text than just at face value, black and white. You know what I mean? So this idea of I'm going to emulate the gods and become a god and self-deify and all this stuff, which comes from left-hand path, is actually one of the most, as Tristan described, one of the highest classical sins of hubris.
Right, that's the case. I mean, even the idea that you might be capable of emulating the gods, of determining right and wrong like they do, is, I mean, it's indescribably arrogant to think that you might be as wise about wisdom as Odin is. And even Odin is punished. The other gods punish him for his consequentialist behavior. Can you imagine what they would do to people?
Yeah. And maybe they are doing it to people. And, the people are just have turned away from them so far that they don't even realize it. So the next on the list here, you have contractarianism.
Right. Contractarianism is the idea that man should act according to the rules they have agreed to obey in society. And although this is an objective form of morality, the rules you have agreed to obey can be measured against its unchanging. This is often the basis of liberal position, classical liberalism, which has given rise to many of the ills in our society. The idea that everyone has a certain set of rights and obligations that we have agreed in just by being born in society, the notion of the social contract, has... It produces a certain situation in which just because you've agreed to things in society, those things might be wrong. You know, your society might be incorrect. It might be vice-ridden and terrible, plagued with immense immorality. But just because you've agreed to do so means you should continue doing bad behavior is an indescribable moral position here that cannot be the correct decision for any man to make.
Exactly. As we mentioned many, many times before, our morality is objective. It's like it's democracy. It's the rule of the mob. Yeah.
Our ancestors have a quote about this in the sagas. If I'm going to paraphrase it here, I might get it slightly incorrect. That when one is faced with what is right and what the law is, and those differ, better it is to do with what is right. And that is actually from the sagas, that our ancestors were against contractionalism.
Yeah, big time. And if you look at society, like societies in Africa and stuff, some of the like really horrific practices that they do. Like you look at the virgin cure. You know, the virgin cure is absolutely despicable. You know, I mean, and this goes back to like animism stuff. This is what, you know, a lot of animism is kind of like a popular. It's like a pop culture kind of. Sentiment that people are bringing into the Germanic tradition now, but it really only comes from third world places. And animism is very dangerous because it adds in contractualism, and animus believe that everything is divine. We can get into how if everything is divine, then nothing is divine. But that's a whole, we could do that whole other show about that. We'll talk about it another time. But in these animist societies, they have this contractualism where they, you know, you have these like shamans that say that they're the only ones to discern what is, you know, what is holy and what is good and what is right. And out of that came what is called the Virgin Cure. And what was going on is you had these like witch doctors that were, you know, telling AIDS-ridden men to go have sex with virgins, and that will cure their AIDS. And when it was actually first seen by missionaries and stuff, and then also by like Doctors Without Borders or like whatever those people are. Those guys went overseas to see this, what was going on, why there's so much AIDS going on, why there's like, you know, little kids with these AIDS-ridden men were literally raping like babies and stuff because
because they can be sure that a baby is a virgin,
and that comes from contractualism. And that comes from some of the stuff that we were talking about before, where if you have like the one horn, where if God says it, then it's true, and not true because, you know, God doesn't say it because it's true. You know, these men are saying, well, this is true because I am the divine speaker. I'm the voice of the divine. I say this is right, and it's a societal contract to uphold this, and therefore now AIDS-ridden men are raping babies. This is the kind of stuff, and obviously this kind of stuff would never happen in the West among, you know, somewhat virtuous people, but we are sliding into a age of darkness where we're seeing degeneracy like we've never seen before. Like, this kind of stuff is going to, you know, contractualism is very dangerous, and it is not true. Our truth, our law, our morality is objective and comes from natural law, comes from Erlog.
Right. It's important to understand that our theological law should always triumph any sort of civil law. Now, I'm not telling people go out and break the law. You should be smart about this. But you should understand that just because something is legal or illegal does not make that necessarily right or wrong.
Yeah. So that doesn't necessarily mean, well, there's no speed limits in the Eddas, so I'm going to drive 100 miles an hour everywhere. That's not what we're saying here. What we're saying is if society tries to put you in contract to do something that you know is objectively wrong, then you are obligated to do what is right.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I would like to continue on here to do a summary about ethics in the ancient Germanic people to re-explain about which forms of morality our ancestors actually believed in and followed. And there are four of them here. Our ancestors believed in divine command, the notion that if the gods say we should do this, we should do this. They believed in deontology, that our moral actions should be guided upon based on what is our duty to do, to uphold. And they also used virtue ethics, which is the classical virtues of Aristotle, that determined from natural law, that these things should be followed because they are the good. But there's a last one here that we haven't touched on, and that's the notion of dual morality. And dual morality can often cause a lot of issues with modern pagans because they look into the historical sources of what our ancestors were doing, and it confuses them. But I'm going to lay it out here so everyone can understand. And that this is actually where a lot of the left-hand path sources actually derive therefrom, is a misunderstanding of dual morality. Dual morality is the concept that there exists an in-group and an out-group. And we have terms for this, metaphysical terms in the Germanic faith. We call it the Innengard and the Utengard. That's the inside the fence and outside the fence. Those who are our family, friends, guests, members of the community, or other people we have relations to exist within the law, within the Innengard. And within the Innengard, people are subject to moral duties and norms. So, for instance, you don't rape people who are within the Innengard because that is bad. You don't kill them. You don't steal from them. You don't lie to them. All of these classical virtues are upheld within the Innengard. But there is the second group, the people who are in the Utengard, that exist outside of law. And these are primarily made up of outlaws who have been ejected from the Innengard because they do not follow law, and foreigners who exist without any sort of relationship to the people in here. Now, to be foreigners, I would have to say that this isn't necessarily based on what a state is. Whether or not someone is a foreigner in this case means whether or not they have any sort of formalized relationship with another person. If this is just some far-off people in, you know, Mongolia, these people are probably Utengard. And our ancestors believed that people who are in the Utengard are not, they don't have the bounds of law upon them. And so you can do whatever you want to them. They don't have moral strictures. You can steal from them and kill them and rape them and whatever it is you want might wanted to do. And our ancestors took full advantage of this when they did things, for instance, like the Viking raids or Germanic tribes raiding across borders.
Now, that doesn't mean you should go around the world, you know, raping. That's
no.
Definitely.
Please
not
don't do that.
Please don't do that. So,
right, but yeah. I should make the point that our ancestors did believe in dual morality, and that explains the sudden divergence people have, the confusion they see when, for instance, they believe that murder is wrong, but then a Viking goes off to England and then kills people, and they don't understand why our ancestors believed this and how they were processing it.
So, how does dual morality work in today's world? And how does that, because I mean, some people are going to ask, well, doesn't this clash with objective morality? If rape is always wrong, why is it okay to go, you know, rape somebody that's an outsider?
Well, the answer to that is because we think that rape is wrong because it has the natural source from natural law, that societies that rape each other within their society fall apart. You would need vengeance and people get angry and it would destroy society in ways I'm certain everyone can imagine. But people who are outside of your society, who exist outside of the law, you don't have that concern upon them. You don't care what it affects them because these people aren't part of your society. So, you know, if you kill someone from a different people, it doesn't matter to your society. It won't kill your society. It won't break them apart. You're not going to create blood feuds between neighbors.
But you're not advocating for going and doing that.
No,
you're
no, no.
Saying,
I mean, there's no reason to actually go out and kill people, of course.
What you're saying is that if they do that to each other, then it's none of our concern.
More or less. I mean, if we have to understand that the reason we have the natural law is that we can tell that this is why we do this because this. We don't kill people because a society that goes around killing other members of the society falls apart. When that stops being the case for like a foreigner and they're not a part of your society, well, then it loses its moral justification. It's okay to kill those people in an objective moral sense because they're not part of your society. It will not produce a negative effect. Of course, you shouldn't do it because I mean, that's probably going to produce a bad consequence in today's society. But metaphysically speaking, you're not going to go to Nastron because you killed a foreigner that you had nothing to do with.
Yeah. And so this idea of, and this is talking, we're just talking about how our ancestors viewed it. They viewed that anybody that was in the Utengard of the outside, you know, the laws didn't apply to them. Once you left your own people, you could just go do whatever you want. You could just go wild. You know what I mean? But in today's society, obviously that's, you can't get away with that. And I don't know I wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't suggest anybody go do that. But the way that I view this concept in modern society and today is that I just don't care if those people blow each other up. I don't care if those people, rape each other. I don't care what happens to them. You know what I mean? Honestly, I would, if they did great, I would be like, okay, good for you. That's good. I feel good about you guys doing a good job and not raping and murdering each other and blowing each other up. But if it's happening, that has no bearing on me and my folk and my country and what we're doing here. You know what I mean? I'm not going to send them money. I'm not going to go help them. I'm not going to go fight with them. I just don't care. I don't want anything to do with them. So that's kind of how I translate the dual morality idea.
Right, I think that's a very reasonable idea there. Though I would have to defend our ancestors a little bit and say that in the medieval period, if you really, accept their mindset, where they're coming from, and their own condition in life, it's, like my own ancestors certainly were Viking raiders. I'm Scandinavian in heritage. So when my ancestors looked around their farm and said, "We don't have very much wealth, and we should sail off to a different foreign country that we have, it's way far away on the map, and steal their wealth and bring it back." This allowed my their children to grow up strong and well fed and everything. This is and was an objective good for their society, and it's almost hard to defend the idea that they shouldn't have done that. I mean, if you could steal from a foreigner to give your children food tomorrow, wouldn't you do so? Isn't it wrong to not do so?
All of the successful societies in human history have gotten a lot of their wealth from going and plundering, other cultures. It's just the reality of it. And I'm not saying that we should continue to do that, and I'm not advocating for that. You know, I mean, I'm not a violent guy. I don't advocate for violence. I think we could get into all that kind of stuff, my ethics and stuff around warmongering and world policing and all this kind of stuff that can be
Right.
contributed to this. Because Tristan, what you're kind of advocating for, I don't know, I want to say what you're advocating for, but what you're saying was our ancestors' mentality could also be conflated with, like the American murder circus that goes around and like steals
Right.
everybody's oil.
I was actually thinking of that and how I was going to address it. I should note that politically, I myself am almost like an isolationist. I don't believe we should, be politically gallivanting around with our military anywhere outside of our borders. So, I mean, it should be noted that I'm not advocating that we go to, we go invade Iran and Iraq and Syria and take all their oil because they're foreigners. No, in the modern society, we have a very globalized system in which actually, what's happening in Syria very much affects us. The political conditions of these people are have consequences, knock-on consequences for our own society. And part of the complexity, the moral depth of natural law is that we can say we can look further beyond just the initial action about what is going to affect our society. Is doing so going to be good or bad for us in the long run? And we can say that this would be a bad action. It wastes our lives, it wastes our resources, and it doesn't really give us anything good for the long term. And so we should not do this.
And also, I want everybody to keep in mind, it's not that we're necessarily advocating for this, but this is how some of our ancestors viewed the world. I mean, we're just taking we're just observing what our ancestors believed in a time that was very harsh. These were very this was an extremely patriarchal, war-driven society. Our Germanic ancestors were warriors. And they liked to fight, and they didn't care about dying, and they liked to plunder, and they were, they were uncaged, I wouldn't say they were, they were warriors, and this is how they viewed the world.
Well, as my good friend Kerwin says, you can tell when the Indo-Europeans arrived in the archaeological record because it comes with a layer of ash.
Yeah, a layer of carbon. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they can look at dig sites, and they can see when the Indo-Europeans rolled up, because there's a layer of carbon, and from the layer of carbon they can show that the buildings were rebuilt. So these guys rolled up.
Right, they set everything on fire and everything burned down.
That's oh man, what a
But it, yeah, it should be reiterated again that the reason I'm explaining dual morality to everyone is so that when you come across the discussions and the arguments from these left-hand path infiltrators, these satanic infiltrators into the faith, that you should realize that, just because a Viking went off to, Spain and killed someone and took their gold, doesn't mean that he thought it was okay to kill your neighbor and take his gold for no reason. It's different. They had dual morality, and it's not the same. They didn't just have moral arbitrariness. They didn't have no rules. They had very strict rules.
Yeah, exactly. That's a big argument that I have a lot of times. Like, oh well, they didn't really have laws. They didn't have, which is absolutely the opposite. They had very, very rigid, strict laws and codes. They had courts. as you know, not necessarily as we understand courts, but they very much had a system of punishment. They had all of these things, and they were very, very rigorous, and they were very
right. It says in Njal's saga, it says, "By the law will our people be built up and thrive."
Yeah, exactly. So when we get into this kind of stuff, this is really the discussion of dual morality is really a tool to give you kind of like a look into what these people, our ancestors, believed in that time period, so you can better understand the arguments of, well, they raped and murdered and pillaged, so therefore might is right. And blah, blah, blah. No. That's not what that meant. They believe that, you know, as we described, morality for the inside and then the outside people, you could do whatever you want. Not necessarily what that was just during the medieval period and stuff like that. That wasn't necessarily all throughout all of Germanic society. That's just, you know, the medieval period. And as I said, it's a tool to understand that and to better construct your arguments against people that say might is right or people that say that they were all evil. Because it's not true.
Right, it's not at all the case.
Absolutely. All right, so, Mr. Tristan, we ran out of time.
Oh, well, you know, Dave, we did tell everyone we were going to do the question and answer session here. So maybe can we give it like 10 minutes?
Okay.
Sure. Everyone can come up with their argument, and I would encourage anyone, if you have any sort of questions you would like to ask us, or, you know, theological questions, advice, or anything of sorts, what's going on in your life, feel free to send it to us. Send us a super chat. We'd make sure we would see it, actually. But we'll try to read them and go through them all.
Yeah. Somebody did say something about, here it is. Ancestral Weapons says, animism, for what I understand, is the belief that all things possess spirit, and that is definitely present in European paganism. What definition are you going by, Dave? No, I disagree that it was involved in European paganism. I don't think that, I have not seen any sort of evidence that supports that animism was found within, European paganism. I think that animism is inherently a third world belief because our ancestors believed in, imminent divinity, not animism. Animism is the belief that, all things are animate. Everything, rocks, trees, everything has a spirit. Does a rock really have a spirit?
Right. I would add that it can be confusing for some people when they look at the existence of the Alfar, for instance. The Alfar can be nature divinities in a sense. You know, the Alfars, they have, you know, named after barley and streams and trees. We have grottos that are sacred to Thor and whatnot. But this is very different from the animistic notion that literally everything has its own specific spirit. This was never a Germanic belief at all. No one believed that this bush has its own spirit or this rock has its own spirit. Though they did believe that certain regional locations or certain conceptuals like barley or corn or wheat would have an Alfar associated with them that ruled over the domains in question. But that's very different from the animist notion that literally everything had a spirit.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's like, if you believe that everything is divine, then nothing is divine. And even back to, you go back to the like the Neolithic farmers that built Stonehenge. Stonehenge was a solar monument. That was those people looking up to the stars. That was people looking up to the heavens. That wasn't people believing that the stones had spirit. And also this goes into, taking a step back, what is a spirit? And if you watched our last episode about afterlife, we went very deeply into what the Germanic view of the soul components were and how actually complex it was. And the idea of just having a spirit is kind of an outside belief as well. So if somebody told me, well, nature has a sort of essence about it, I mean that's something that's a little bit more digestible for me. But to assume animism is to also assume the kind of Abrahamic Middle Eastern idea of just having a basic spirit, which is completely off the tracks from the very complex idea of having soul components and like multiple different aspects of the soul that our ancestors believed. So animism is very, very simple. It comes from very primitive cultures. It is not found in European paganism or the Germanic tradition. It's not found in the Greek tradition. And I would like to see any sort of source material that anybody can produce to prove that.
Right, I would agree with your notion there. And for the next thing we're coming in the chat, I'm looking at a long argument going on with the between some of the people and libertarian heathen here, who makes the claim that natural law is, or libertarianism is natural law enshrined in an economic and political system. And I'll answer that by saying very bluntly, no, it is not. That confuses the notion of might makes right or a meritocracy with natural law. Natural law is very different. Natural law is what produces the best effects for a society. We know that our ancestors were not capitalists. They were not libertarians. When the Germanic tribes allocated land amongst their tribe, they changed it year to year based upon this family gets this much now because this is what we have. This is what they need. And all the tribe held the land in common. Amongst the Nordic peoples, they had a caste system, a literal caste system composed of thralls, which were slaves, carls, which were freemen, and jarls. People paid taxes and had moral and legal obligations to their lord. Not only that, but people had obligations legally speaking. They couldn't just do whatever they want. They had obligations to morality. They had obligations to the law. And we have examples of our ancestors punishing people very strongly who deviated from these sorts of things.
Yeah. Now, he also, Libertarian Heathen's actually a friend of mine. He's a friend of mine for a long time. He's a good guy. So, but he also makes a really fair point here. He says, as far as global, you can have concentric circles of loyalty, beginning with individual through tribe, nation, and globe. Yeah,
that's true. That's exactly how our ancestors reckoned kinship, was a concentric circle in which the first circle was composed of your closest kin, your father, your grandfather, your mother, your siblings, and I think your first cousins as well. And these were all the closest circle of kin. And as you started increasing it, they got further and further distant. And it was actually encoded in the legal system itself, whereas if something happened to your first circle of kin or they did something, you would have to pay a higher fine based upon your relation to them. Or you were exhibited less application of vengeance because they were further away from you.
Yeah. And we have a very generous super chat, $20, from Angarad Celtic. It says, hail. No question. I just want to show my support. Love to the folk. Much love to you. Many blessings. Thank you very much. Hail to you as well. Hail to the folk. Hail to the gods. Hail victory. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. We definitely appreciate your contribution.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I would actually like to address that a little bit, too, because I saw some argument there about you know, like racial materialism and folkishness as well. I would like to discuss that just real quick. I think that might be the last one we really have time for, though. We should understand that, yes, our faith is folkish in nature, that it's based upon the notion that our blood is important, our heritage is important. But we should also understand that racial materialism is not something that our ancestors actually believed in. Our conception of folkishness comes from a metaphysical idealism instead of materialism. That it comes from the soul system based on patrilineal reincarnation. That people were reborn within the souls of their patrilineal kin. Your son, your grandson, your great-grandson could become your ancestor, right? And this is how we gained Haminya from the gods. If you go back to the Rigstula, Jarl is taken as claimed as his son, I have claimed you by Rig, and taught the runes. This is part of the way the focus soul is transmitted is through hereditary means. But that should not be conflated with the idea of racial materialism, but just strict biology. It's actually a matter of the soul.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a whole thing that we can get into is folkishness versus materialism and all that. Because a lot of people conflate it and get some ideas a little bit mixed up, and unfortunately they get it a little bit wrong. And our position is a little bit different than, like, it's a very transcendent idea. It's a very deep spiritual idea. Your folk are, it's much, much more, it has much more profound spiritual importance than just other people that look like you. It's, like, far deeper than that. And it's far more exclusive than that as well. It's not just people that look like you. It's people that are related to you and people that you share oath with. It's there's a lot to it, and it's really beautiful stuff. And those people that are coming from, like, a vague, folkish background, I would really implore them to come join the conversation with us as we dig into that kind of idea as well. So that's... yeah, that's a really good stuff. But we are effectively out of time, Mr. Tristan, unfortunately. So much discussion going on in the chat, and I'd like to address it all. But unfortunately, I got to get to bed. I got kids, and I got work, and I got a life like a normal human. So, Mr. Tristan, do you have anything to conclude with tonight?
No, I don't think I did. I think we covered everything real nicely.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much, everybody. Hang on, people. big old argument in the chat here. So, much love to everybody.
Which is good. I like the interaction. I'm glad for it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's very important that we maintain a culture of debate and argument, because that is something that is very, very important. That separates us from beasts. That separates us from more. I'm sorry, Tristan, what were you going to say?
Well, yeah, actually, I do have something I would like to end with, Dave, that because as we started out the program, that we're going to continue to have this ending session of question and answers. Think until the next episode or next week. Think about what you want to ask us. Do you have any sort of theological questions you would like answered? Any historical questions? We will definitely try to answer them to the best of our knowledge if you just send them to us. Hopefully you guys have the time in which we can see some major interaction and get some really good questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so thank you again for the wonderful donations, and thank you again for everybody for tuning in tonight, man. Before we close out, I want to give one more shout-out to my homegirl, like always, Miss Hannah, Traditional Apothecary, traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Stop giving your money to the multinational globalist vampires that hate your guts and sell you poison and synthetics and plastics that trash your hair, trash your body, trash your skin. Instead, opt out of the beast. Opt out of the machine that destroys you. And give your money to somebody that loves you, that makes a wonderful, organic product that grows from the earth. It's good for you, man. Our ancestors, our folk, gifted us with such wonderful, beautiful features, and we should let it shine for all the world to see. We got to be maximum beautiful out here, maximum handsome. So make sure to go over to traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com, get some beard oil, get some lotion, get some shampoo, some conditioner, get all kinds of good stuff, and so you could be maximum shining and handsome, just like your boy Big Dave. So keep your white bright, keep your beard robust, and keep your mane flowing just like me. And Dr. G, my mom, my wife, all the awesome people that use it. I get so many messages, people that use it and appreciate it. So traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com, promo code Dave. Like, subscribe, share, click the alert button so you can get alert every time we go live here on Dave Martell channel, which is on the blog, every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern. Little alert bell, I believe it's like up in the corner or somewhere. You guys know where it is. Click on it, and then you guys can get the alert every time we go live, because I know YouTube likes to mess around with guys like us, and we all know the score. But anyway, thank you everybody for tuning in tonight. I hope you guys enjoyed the program. Next week, we have my buddy, the Folkish Farmer, coming on to talk about ancestral diets, ways to come up with recipes and stuff that are more affordable, very great, practical solutions for people and their lives, their everyday lives, practical stuff, so that we can further immerse ourselves in the ancestral primordial path of our awesome ancestors. So you guys are really, really going to love that program. I guarantee it's going to be great. You guys are going to really love it. So anyways, I'll see you guys next week, Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern. Many hails. Hail to you guys. Hail the gods. Hail the folk. Hail victory. I'll see you guys next week. Much love. Many blessings, guys. I'll see you next week.